You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode number 167 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
I'm starting it off with a sigh.
Just hearing the name Seahawks causes a sigh. Well, plenty more to come on the Seahawks, including an interview this week with Mike Sando, newly of The Athletic, about QB tiers and plenty about the Seahawks in there as well. But let's get started with this week's beer from our sponsor, Tavor. Tavor is an app that offers craft beers that aren't distributed nationwide for purchase. Breweries like Buckle Down Brewery in Chicago, the makers of the much-loved Xavier McDaniel IPA, make their beers available to Tavor. You order the ones you like, and they'll be shipped together on a regular basis for a flat shipping cost. Going forward, we'll be drinking beer sent to us by Tavor on the pod each week, and you can take advantage too. If you sign up for an account with Tavor and enter the code PeltonCast in the promos section of the app, you'll get $10 credit after spending $25 with Tavor. What are we drinking from there this week?
We are drinking from Anchorage Brewing Company in Anchorage, Alaska, the Vias Double IPA.
Are we sure it's Anchorage, Alaska, not a different Anchorage?
Yes.
Okay.
The Vias Double IPA.
I'm being sarcastic.
Good one.
It comes in these handy camouflage cans, as you'll see on our Instagram story when I post them.
And I just poured some out.
You couldn't, you didn't.
I was looking at the camo cans trying to read it, and I poured it all over myself.
Off to a flying start, as usual, on the Pelton Cast. So I think Kulu is a maker of hunting apparel.
That's Kulu?
Yeah.
I was trying to pronounce that like an I.
Yeah, you're right. No, it definitely is an I.
Kuyu? God, we are just
on top of it.
Yeah, we know a thing or two about hunting gear in Alaska.
Specialized hunting apparel and equipment.
If there's a thing that we know about, it is that.
Fabulous Pelton Brothers.
Look, you might know a thing or two about hydroplanes, women's basketball, quarterback tiers.
Oh, man, I forgot we needed to preview the Tri-Cities Hydro Race this week.
I don't know if we really...
We'll save it for Seafair.
Hey, save it for Seafair, buddy.
All right, a toast this week, too. This is for the second consecutive week, to Edgar Martinez, who was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame last Sunday. An outstanding speech from Edgar. Emotional at times, thanked everybody, made some jokes. It was great times.
They say the word gooey duck?
He did not say the word gooey duck, nor light bat.
It's a light bat.
No, never came up. We're going to have a little more on this in a second, because it's time to reminisce about the 1995 Mariners.
There we go.
Yes. I've seen the documentary now on MLB Network. But before we get to that, also a toast, as usual, to
us.
The upcoming, yes, third annual Pelton Cast Live.
As usual.
Well, I mean, it's on the rundown each week. Friday, September 6th at Belltown Yacht Club. Doors at 7 p.m. Tickets are available now for $10, with 50% of those proceeds going to the Family First Center in Renton, spearheaded by former Seahawks wide receiver Doug Baldwin. And our special guest, as you know, guest third Pelton brother, Ben Baldwin.
Hello.
Of the Athletic Seattle.
There we go.
So the summer of live shows, the summer of football.
Wow, we should
live
ask
shows.
Mike Sando to come on the live show.
The summer of football related live shows.
You're going to hear later, but maybe we could have a tete-a-tete.
It could be fun. Summer of football related live shows kicked off this week on Monday.
Oh, I meant to ask about this.
The Mina Kimes show featuring Lenny coming to Seattle.
Are you interested and able to talk about the Mina Kimes show?
I both of those things, yeah.
How was it?
It was great.
I've got a lot of questions. Tell me about it.
Is this creased now? So Danny Kelly was the first special guest.
Wow.
They
pretty uncreative, Mina.
Mina and I were walking out of the building later that night. I asked him to rake his live podcast appearances.
Where did the first ever Peltoncast Live come
in? He said it was a 1A and 1B situation. He couldn't pick between them.
So it's like picking between Tri-City Waterfallies and Seafair.
Oh, that's an easy choice, though. Waterfalls is way better. He and Mina previewed the NFC West. There was an early shout out to Ben.
Of course.
As well as an early running backs don't matter.
There we go.
Because obviously they were, you know, when you Todd Gurley comes up.
We should have asked Mike Sando whether running backs matter. But I think we know the answer.
We already got into a lot. I'm trying to think of what else was highlights of that, but a number of jokes about the number of the Cardinals playing five wide receiver sets. Oh, and also the idea that they're trying to run 90 plays per game this year, apparently.
Really?
I mean, you also can listen to this. The podcast is available on the Medicom Show feed. So after she and Danny wrapped up, then it was after talking about, they talked about the Seahawks and copious DVOA references. Mm-hmm. Then KJ Wright came on.
Wow.
Is the second special
there
guest.
There we go. And this KJ Wright, right?
Yeah. This was known previously. KJ Wright was a natural. He had
really?
Like the perfect tone for it.
Do you think
it.
He's available September 6th at Belltown Yacht Club?
He probably is not.
She's stealing ideas from us. We should be able to steal from her.
I think he'll probably be busy in game preparation for the opening game that Sunday against the Cincinnati Bengals. So I don't think he'll be a third Pelton brother at our live show, but... He like
we'll see if KJ Reddick's available.
Yeah, so many quotable things within the span of like a half hour on stage. It was pretty awesome.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, KJ Wright was great.
He was outstanding.
Were there any surprise special guests?
There were not any. Just Lenny appearing via Skype.
Oh, via Skype.
Yeah, apparently does not fly well, according to Mina.
What was the crowd like? What percentage of Seahawks Twitter did you see there?
Seahawks Twitter. I don't know, about half. Speaking of live shows, our friend Mike from Tasteful Profanity at Beast Pope Production was there. He was the first, literally the first person I saw when I walked in.
He's very
before
large,
doors
so.
Open. Yeah, sure. He's easy to spot. So we
and
hung
his
out
here in his glasses.
We hung out beforehand, and then he also was out later. So hung out with him. Saw several of the listener. So that was great.
Really. I want you to shout out exact names. I'm trying to hear who was there.
Mike was hanging out with Will Cornell, by the way, at Rain City Series on Twitter. And then we were joined by Jesse, the axiomatician.
Wow.
Third Pelton, legendary third Pelton brother.
Is he coming to the live show?
I think so.
This is now devolved into our actual conversations.
It is. Yeah. Loyal listener Greg and his friends hung out with them a little bit beforehand.
Okay.
That because the famous cousin Katie and her husband were late getting there.
Oh, there we go.
Let's see who else. A fan came up and introduced themselves afterwards.
Really?
But I don't think they were a listener to the podcast. Unclear about that.
They were just a fan of you personally.
That person was holding a Rashard Lewis jersey.
Oh, hello.
Yeah. So
a fan came up and introduced themselves after. You get that on the streets a lot, though.
Yeah, all the time. Like, yeah, you just can't walk without getting mobbed. I feel like there should be one other listener that I saw, but I can't remember.
I can't
who
believe
was
you up. And Katie were in the house and I wasn't there.
I know. You were sorely missed. Not really.
Nobody brought you up. Did you get shouted out at all?
Not during the show, no.
Wow. And then you went and hung out after?
Yeah.
Was Zach there?
Zach was not there. He had a work function, apparently, and wasn't able to make it.
Damn.
We checked in with him.
What did you think of the venue for the show?
It was really good. It was apparently very hot in the front. I was sitting in the back, and it was blissfully cool. There was a row set out that said reserved seats that I assumed that, you know, I could take one of those. No one else sat in any of those chairs the entire show.
You assume they were reserved for other famous podcasters like yourself. Oh my God. I feel like the famous cousin Katie should have at least taken one.
I did tell her to come sit down, but
you didn't
never
sit
did.
Next to Katie and Ben?
Well, I sat down when the show started. They weren't there yet.
Oh.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. Well, part of it, to go behind the scenes. Google Maps, if you try to go to the Crocodile, which was the venue for this show, it tells you to go on the tunnel because it's directly over the tunnel, but it's directly over the tunnel. So they ended up driving all the way back south to the south end of the tunnel.
Google
they
Maps,
were just like
when you're
you
driving to the Crocodile, doesn't take you to the right place?
No. They were just like you getting on I-5 south from any direction. That's
I did the same thing when we were driving out to our retreat this time, too. We were trying to get onto I-90 heading east, and we got onto 518 south to go there. I'm telling you, I only go south. I've told you time and time again.
Hashtag Pelicancast geography.
I only go south. That sounds great. So like you mentioned.
But it was, I mean, it was a full house, like standing room only. There were probably like 150 seats somewhere in that neighborhood. And aside from the reserved ones that no one else was sitting besides me, they were all taken and people standing in the back and on the side. So it was a great crowd. Everybody was very excited to be there, excited about generally about the Seahawks. There were also fans wearing other teams' jerseys. Derrick Henry jersey, I think, got shouted out during the pod.
Wow.
Yeah.
Derrick Henry.
Yeah.
Maybe that run last year won his fantasy league.
We were discussing that before.
Were you really?
Just his fantasy season and how bizarre it was.
Well, again, summer of live podcast. You had the Mina Kimes show earlier this week, August 16th at Fuel in Pioneer Square. We have Beast Pode Live.
I don't know if you heard. Apparently, we're fighting at this.
Oh, are we?
Yeah, did you not see this on Twitter?
No, what are we fighting about?
We're fighting about the fact that, let's see, who was it? Oh, at Jason Cheatox called us the official podcast of Seattle Sports Twitter.
Yes. And then who said we were fighting about that?
Mike said we're fighting about
that. Oh, good, good.
Yeah.
Good.
His response was from at BeastPod was, yes, we accept your invitation for a death match.
Great.
So be there to find out if this actually happens. Spoiler alert, it won't.
There are certain competitions we could beat them in.
I'm not sure what that... Oh, you know what, by the way, the best part of the show was, and this is a thing that we know will be replicated at Beltline Yacht Club, you have guaranteed me. I went into the backstage afterwards.
Wow.
Strictly Rainier in the fridge. Rainier Tall Boys.
There we go.
Friend of the pod, Meg Rowley of Fangraphs, posted a photo of her and Mina there, and as Mike tagged us in, it is a nice use of a Raider tall boy in that photo.
I saw that.
Yep.
All right, there we go. Well, and then finally on September 6th, as you mentioned, where can tickets be gotten at?
If you go to at PeltonCast on Twitter or to the PeltonCast
site. Could we pin a tweet?
We already did it.
Wow.
We're way ahead of you.
One step ahead.
Yeah. This is a professional operation. I don't know why you think not.
Except for the podcast part of it.
Yeah.
September 6th at Belltown Yacht Club. You know what to expect from PeltonCast Live. Come hungry. Come ready to participate in activities. We'll probably have some hats available.
I hope I've heard
that there might be t-shirts.
The famous Cousin Giddy and I talked about it.
Oh, there we go. Show.
So, yeah, we're continuing. Those are in the works.
Surprises?
Yeah.
Just KJ Wright?
No, not KJ Wright. We cannot promise KJ Wright. KJ Wright will not be there.
But we can promise DJ Infrared.
We can promise
that. And you want him even more than you want KJ Wright, even if you don't know it.
That's accurate. I mean, KJ Wright was good, but I don't think he's as funny as DJ Infrared.
There you go.
Should we talk about the 1995 Mariners?
Absolutely, we should.
All right. So as we discussed last week, MLB Network put together a documentary, the 1995 Mariners Saving Baseball in Seattle, narrated by the one and only McElmore.
Yes.
It was surprisingly difficult to find this on my DVR to record it, but eventually I was able to and watch it. It's a brisk, it's 1 hour with commercials, so it's like probably a 48-minute runtime in terms of the actual documentary. And there's a lot to cover. They have to kind of explain the context of why the team was in danger of moving. I did think it was surprising. They never mentioned the sale of the team to, you know, an investment group led by Nintendo's chairman.
That happened during that season?
It didn't happen during that season, but it was kind of important context that they were already on the verge of moving in 1991 before that happened.
Oh, and that's what kept the team in Seattle before then?
Yeah.
Okay.
But then they decided that they needed a new baseball-only facility after the ceiling tiles fell. Which got a lot. They also didn't mention that there was a strike that ended the 1994 season. Like, I mean, I get why.
I feel like they got through the entire season very quickly.
They did get through the entire season very quickly.
And gave enough weight to all the different points along the way.
Which a lot happened in the 1995 season.
A lot happened.
I love the story from Doug Strange that Griffey told his teammates he would homer on opening night and did. One of the many games that season that we attended.
That was opening. We went to opening night.
You sure did.
I mean, there's so many games. I could not tell you any individual, I could tell you actually a lot of individual games because they were very important in the history of baseball in Seattle.
Yes.
But after watching that, I mean, everybody is nostalgic for the 95 Mariners, right? Like, if you were born and raised in the years, I don't know, 1975 through 1990, probably, maybe even stretching back farther in Seattle.
I'd say, I think that anyone, like, if you were born at any point and were a Mariners fan, you had never seen the team make the playoffs.
Yes.
So.
But if you sort of came up as a baseball fan, as we did, this...
I mean, we were the perfect age for it.
This was probably the most important team I've ever followed in my entire life.
I still might go 93-94 Sonics for me.
I don't remember it's that much about the 93-94 Sonics. I mean, I have other seasons that I really, really cared about. There's obviously Seahawks seasons, but I will never in my entire life care about anything as much as I cared about the Mariners as a 10-year-old.
Exactly, because that the age is such a crucial factor in that. Yeah.
And just the ability to be so singularly focused on this. But then also, I've got childhood nostalgia wrapped up in these feelings. And so it's like, I just do not think that I could care about anything. And like, it's almost insane how many deep personal emotions I have about my life that are wrapped up in this baseball team that didn't even make the World Series.
Wait, you have that many deep personal emotions?
Oh, yes. It's like... The primary memories that I have of this are, you weren't even involved in a lot of it. You were busy with math club.
Not math club. I just had math at like 7:25 in the morning at Taiyi High School.
There we go. Shouts to Taiyi High School. The days that we would get, I would be home or whatever from fifth grade. I was in fifth grade. When I was 10, I think I was in fifth grade.
I'd need a second to determine that.
I'd get home or whatever from school and our dad would get off work early and then be like, do you want to go to the baseball game today? Especially as things were moving, because that was the climate at the time. It's something that now when I think of it is kind of unheard of to just casually go to a sporting event, because like there's really nothing that casual about going to almost any sporting event. But to make that decision at like 5 o'clock, the day that the game is happening at 7 o'clock.
I mean, it was a lot easier to park by the kingdom back then.
It was
then.
Easier to park. The tickets were $8 to $10 and fairly good seats.
And readily available because it was, a giant dome stadium. And I mean, not that they're not readily available at this point.
Oh, yes. The tickets are readily available. Much more expensive. It just, everything about it feels so much more difficult than it did then, though.
Oh, 100%. Right?
And so we would just casually at 5 o'clock decide to go to the Mariners game that night.
Oh, also traffic. That's another thing that was totally different back then.
And then go and see this baseball team that you really fell in love with throughout the year. And it felt like that was the only time. We probably did it in the 96 season or whatever. But this was the exact moment that they were beloved and they were still our team. Right? Does that make sense? They still sort of emotionally belonged to the people who were there beforehand, which we were.
I feel like as long as they were in the kingdom, they did. But I get what you're saying.
To me, like every year after that, and I think that's part of the reason why I personally, if we're getting like personal about it, part of the reason that I stopped really paying attention to baseball was because I felt like it was something like, it's like an indie band, right?
Yeah.
Where it was like the Mariners in the early 90s were like this cool indie band that had these like weird, like very exciting players that no one gave a shit about.
I mean, they almost moved. They had all these Hall of Famers.
Even in Seattle, like we loved Ken Griffey Jr. and all of our friends loved Ken Griffey Jr. But it was like, it still felt like this like weird niche thing that we were a part of before anybody else. Even though it's a baseball team that's playing in a stadium of 60,000.
Yeah.
Right?
All these things are accurate.
This was like, okay, Arcade Fire, right? This is Arcade Fire. Their first record, still a massive record, but you could sort of feel like if you were at like the KXP Christmas show early on, you're like, okay, I still like own this band.
Wait, were you at the KXP?
It was 21 plus. I wasn't able to go. I was under 21. But it was like, I knew about them early. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? And it's like, I can own this band for a long time. And that's what the 95 Mariners were. But then there's also even in our family history of like the memories, the best memories that I have of being around our dad was going to these games in the 1995 season, right? There's like the memory, there was like a Doug Strange pinch hitting thing, right?
Yeah, that's heavily covered in the documentary. So that was the game the day of the vote.
We were at that game.
I was not at that game.
You weren't at a lot of these games.
I was at many of them.
You were at many games, but it was like this time period that I'm talking about.
Yeah, September.
Sort of like the August, September period, where it was like we would just casually go and things were moving and we could all kind of feel it moving too. It was like something's happening here. And in the city, you could feel it. And we would just like be going to these huge baseball games that are being on documentaries 25 years later.
Did you stay for the Griffey hit to end the game?
We were there for the entire thing.
Wow, because that must have been late. That was at least, it's got to be like 11.
What do we care?
I mean, you did have school the next morning and you were nine.
Like, I didn't have math club at 7:25 a.m.
You sure didn't.
I wasn't at Taiyi High School.
Still have class, not a club.
Anyway, so what we're talking about is like this baseball team, both like personal family memories, was the some of the most important in my life. And they're this baseball. It's not like it was a team that was fleeting. It was like everybody else also cares about it.
Yeah.
It would be like if everybody else thinks that your nostalgia is really awesome.
Yes, I guess that's accurate. One of my takeaways from this documentary is that we just don't talk about Doug Strange enough because that guy was involved in so many huge plays that year.
The people that they mentioned, you'd hear like Rich Amaral get mentioned one time.
That was enough. That was good.
Was all you needed?
I think it may be twice. There might have been two Rich Amaral
Alex Diaz shows. Got mentioned?
Yes.
I was like, hell yeah, Alex Diaz.
Dirty Diaz.
It's funny though, the other part is how little of my nostalgia for the team has to do with Edgar Martinez.
Well, that specific team or the Mariners in general?
The Mariners in general, really.
I disagree with that.
I liked Edgar, and he was a very good hitter, but it was just like, we were Ken Griffey Jr. kids.
Well, yeah. I mean, he was the most exciting player in baseball, and he was on our team.
Okay, so we were at, if we can talk through what you remember of this. Game 5, AL Division
Series. Wait, we're jumping way too far.
Okay, you
want to
do more? I thought you wanted to hustle this along.
No.
Okay.
Okay, so another thing that they should have mentioned at some point in this was the Andy Benes trade, which was basically the first time in Mariners history that they had ever traded for a player at the deadline. Like, I can remember where I was when the Mariners traded for Andy Benes.
They went on a freaking trading spree after that.
They did do a nice job of explaining that, like, Vince Coleman and...
Well, I'm saying the years, subsequent years after that.
I mean, Terry Mulholland.
Yeah, and Jeff Fassero.
Yeah. Well, Fassero was off-season. He wasn't a mid-season
trade. That was off-season?
Moyer was the mid-season trade.
Jamie Moyer, they traded Jose Cruz Jr.
Yes.
Still sad.
He would have made it if he had stayed in Seattle.
He'd be in the Hall. It would have been him going to the Hall of Fame on Sunday. Wow. If they wouldn't have traded Jose Cruz Jr. Well, for two relievers.
Like Timlin and Paul Spolcherek. They did do a nice job explaining how the entire run for the Mariners was set up by the fact that the wild card existed. Like, one of the what-ifs here is, if the wild card didn't exist that year, they don't make the Andy Benes trade because they were way back in the division. So even though they didn't win the wild card still is the reason they made the playoffs.
Yeah.
Which
That's
is a
interesting.
Weird thing.
Who did they trade for Andy Benes?
Mark Newfield and Ron Valone, I want to say.
They really ended up in these deadline trades trading a lot of, like, future star players.
Not in that trade.
Well, not in that one, obviously.
You took out Jason Veritek and Derek Lowe for Heathcliff Slocum. Yeah, that was a great one. Big fan. Shouts to Woody Woodward. Okay, so
that's interesting, though.
Another game that stands out to me, there's one that we were not at.
Well, just a thing about the wild card, though, is basically like, and that's kind of what the documentary is about, this convolution of all of these different things sort of hitting at once, right?
Yes.
Both having sort of like the team with like Lou Piniella and the legendary players plus the young players like A-Rod, and then the situation with the
They didn't really explain A-Rod's role in the 95 Mariners.
I want to talk about him in 1 second.
Okay.
But maybe at the very end. But then at the same time with the wild card, right? And the ceiling tiles falling. Like, a lot really had to happen to go into making this team special.
And the strike. The fact that season started late because of the strike. Like, it was a 144-game season, I believe.
What do you think that affected the...
I mean, it affected, like, they might have passed the Angels. Like, there might not have been a tiebreaker game if it had been a 162-game season.
Interesting.
I don't know who it favored, but... They probably favored the Angels because Griffey missed a larger percentage of the season when he broke his wrist because of that.
Okay, so another game that we weren't at.
the Ken Griffey homer off John Wetland in the ninth at the Kingdom, wearing teal jerseys.
Oh my God.
Do you remember exactly where we were when we were listening? We were not watching this game because it wasn't on TV. That's 1985 was such a different time.
Were we at the Roddy house?
No, we were in our basement eating Skittles.
Eating Skittles?
Yes.
And did we freak out? I have no recollection of this.
There was a thing that you were maybe both of us were doing where you were like eating Skittles and saying pop, and that was supposed to be good luck, and then Griffey hit that home run.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
And Niehaus must have freaked out when it happened too.
Yeah. One of the disappointing things about this documentary is there were way too many road or neutral broadcast calls. Like NFL Network does that so well in NFL films.
Yeah.
They always use the local
call. Yeah, we only want to hear Niehaus's calls.
They did it on the two biggest plays,
yeah,
which we'll talk about in a second, but I think this was one where they had a neutral call and it was like, give me Niehaus. Give me Niehaus or failing that Riz.
I wish that I remembered this.
I'm stunned that you don't. That is like a visceral memory for me.
I was 10 years old.
I mean, I was 13. It's not like it was that different. The fact that the Mariners had to play the tie-breaking game was actually like really low-key disappointing.
So how did the game against the Angels?
Yes.
Against the California Angels.
Which I'm stunned that we didn't skip school and go to in hindsight.
Maybe I think the demand for that was very high.
I would imagine so. But it was like they sold them all the day before because they didn't know until then that there was going to be a game to play.
And I'll tell you, Jan would have been excellent at getting those tickets.
She would have been.
If there's one thing that Jan could have done, it's getting tickets to that baseball game. Maybe she had to work and couldn't take off work quickly. So how did the Mariners get the home game? Why was it at home?
It's coin flip.
Oh, wow. That's another thing that happened. I mean, that game's in California.
Oh,
probably
totally
with Randy Johnson starting, but still like...
It's still a different thing.
Okay, so you were in middle school.
That is correct.
By the time this happened, I was in elementary school at Valley View Elementary. And in they called it the pit,
mm-hmm,
right? That's where plays happened. Central of the school.
That's why I played Julius Caesar.
Central of the school, Kevin Pelton Memorial Julius Caesar Theater.
Yeah.
And they have, it was like a couple
of... Sadly, it's no longer a memorial since it's not Valley View anymore.
Somebody spray painted it on Valley View. It's something now, right? The facility?
I think it is something.
It's not abandoned. It'll be on Ghost Adventure soon. The two steps down into just like a big open place for people to do theaters or have classes. Like if you had a presenter, that's typically where it would be.
Oh, that's where Jeff Renner came.
Jeff Renner came there?
Yeah.
Wow.
Not Steve Poole, obviously.
Steve Poole wouldn't show his face
Steve
there.
Steve Poole would never.
They set up a TV in there, one of the giant rolly TVs, right?
I love those TVs.
Set up a TV on there and just turned on the Mariners game. And I remember sitting and watching it. Like, that is an incredible thing that happened when we were 10-year-olds. We just stopped having school because a baseball game was on.
100% appropriate. Were you going to remember what you did in class that day? No, but you remember that watching that game, don't you?
I think that the game ended after we left.
Oh, yeah. Because
I think the Soho hit the inside the park home run. I don't know how it was scored, but the Soho, when he hit the ball and scored.
They all score.
I think we'd just gotten home from school when
I
that
had
happened.
Been home for a while, I know.
Well, you got out earlier.
I did.
But it was like, this was such an important event. I remember having, like, there were newspapers on all of the tables. People on the corner by where the grocery store is or the Mexican sandwiches that we had. People would set up stands over there in Boulevard Park and sell bootleg t-shirts.
Nice.
Right? Do you remember this? We owned so many bootleg t-shirts and they were purchased by stands in Boulevard Park.
I mean, I think Jan still purchased some of those after the Super Bowl. No, I'm not even joking about that.
It's like, this is such an amazing time. How many people cared also?
So one thing I learned from this documentary, the blog Dome and Bedlam, which did a live podcast.
Points to the Dome and Bedlam. And I'm like, oh, hello.
I had no idea that was the origin of the phrase.
Yeah, no idea.
That was the thing I learned. The Yankee series. First two games, not great.
I think I remember listening to the Jim Leyritz homer on the radio because it was late, right?
It was pretty late, yeah.
I think I was like,
even though there was an East Coast game, that one went like 5 hours probably.
Probably the playoffs started fairly late though.
I would bet it was about a 5 o'clock first pitch.
I think I was in bed listening to the radio, and I remember semi angrily turning it off.
That seems plausible.
After He hit that homer. Game two, I have no recollection of.
I thought that was game two.
Oh, I guess whatever game wasn't the Jim Laird's game, I have no recollection of it existing.
So then we attended both games three and five of that series.
And again, game three, that was just a comfortable win, right?
Yeah, that's where Randy Johnson started.
And so game four, I remember being in our living room and the Mariners being down. It felt like an insurmountable lead at the time.
I don't think we were. I recall watching it at our grandparents' house.
No, we were definitely in our living room. I guarantee you we were. And I had gone downstairs. I think
the Huskies had lost to Notre Dame at home earlier in the day.
Damn. You and mom and dad were upstairs.
They failed to cover someone on a 2-point conversion. They just left him completely uncovered. I'm still upset about it. This podcast is great.
And then the run started happening kind of slowly. And
one of the things they didn't mention in the documentary is that Jeff Nelson came in relief in like the third or fourth inning in that game and shut them down for a long period of time. It was quite crucial to the comeback.
But like that Edgar Grand Slam, it was one of those moments where I remember freaking out in our living room.
Yep.
And it was like, we have got this series. When he did that and we came back in game four, it's like, there's no way we're losing game five.
Oh, yeah. Because when you're throwing, I think it was probably Chris Bosio against David Cone. Like, oh, you know you got it then. Like, someone made that comment on the documentary, and I was like, wait a second here. That doesn't check out. It was Andy Benes, actually, who started that game. Not
it was versus
Bosio.
David Cone. It was David Cone was awesome in that game, right?
David Cone's amazing. He threw 147 pitches.
Oh, my God.
In 7 2/3 innings. His last one was, I believe, walking in a run with Doug Strange at the plate.
Wow. God, Doug Strange. And then, whenever there was an important moment in the 1995 baseball season,
Doug Strange was involved. He was like the Forrest Gump of that team.
I want to say about the game that the vote happened, though.
Do you know who came in relief for David Cone in Game 5?
Well, I know Blackjack McDowell came in, but that was an extras.
Yes.
I don't know who came in for him.
Mariano Rivera.
Wow. Mariano, was he a rookie?
Yeah.
Wow. So he's like the A-Rod in his first year and Mariano Rivera.
A-Rod in his second year. He'd played in 94.
Oh, yeah, because this was his rookie season, though.
He was still a rookie.
94,
yes.
He didn't become eligible. So the game that they had the vote, right? I remember on the screen, they were showing stuff about the vote, which is kind of strange, especially because they ended up losing. But I remember they had like animations of people or whatever ticking up to whatever. Was it 50% that they needed?
Yeah.
And so they had like animations of people ticking up to it. And then it like getting there and everybody cheering at the stadium while it was happening.
Huh. That's wild.
You definitely were not at that game, though.
I remember watching that game at home. Yeah. And then game five.
Okay. So game five. Yeah. What do you remember about the game before the very end?
I mostly remember that bottom half of the eighth, I believe it was, where they tied the game and Cone left after throwing 147 pitches. And then Randy Johnson coming in.
Randy Johnson warming up was huge, but he actually gave up a run.
He did.
Right? He gave up the run.
How dare he on one day rest? What are you doing, Randy Johnson?
But I mean, the documentary was like Randy Johnson was unstoppable. There was no chance.
He didn't have six strikeouts out of his nine outs.
Wow.
Randy Johnson was pretty damn good, man.
But it was like...
Everyone forgets that Norm Charlton threw it in inning a third of scoreless relief in that game. That's a forgotten thing.
I definitely remember him giving up that run and just feeling like it's over.
I mean, as they pointed out, the top of the order was coming up.
Sometimes in baseball, a run can feel insurmountable, though.
Oh, for sure.
And that happening, but I think partially because it was also... Like, Jack McDowell was a star.
Yeah.
At that time.
I mean, it wasn't like that different from Randy coming in relief. They had both pitched in Game 3, if I recall correctly. Can I give you my galaxy brain take that I had watching this documentary?
Okay.
It is a Paul George take.
Wow.
Sam Perlazzo was the Mariners' third base coach.
Yes.
Also noted, friend of friends of our family.
Uh-huh. Pelton Cast listener.
Should not have waived Griffey yet. They had runners second and third with nobody out. That was a terrible decision.
I actually, watching it, was like, wow, there were no outs.
Yeah.
What if it could have been the greatest sack fly in Mariners' history? There would have been a bar named Sackfly.
Jay Buhner would be the hero. You wouldn't talk about the double. You'd talk about the Jay Buhner Sackfly. Tino Martinez Sackfly.
It was like a pretty unnecessarily risky play.
All right, so here's my question.
But do you... Okay, so this moment happens. Do you remember freaking out in that moment?
I mean, sort of. It's like one of those things where you remember remembering
more than you actually remember. I wish that there was like a Black Mirror type situation where you could go back to any moment in your life and we could re-experience that. Because watching it on TV is not the same.
Here's another fun... like family thing.
Yes.
Our Christmas cards.
Exactly.
That year,
I was going to say.
With us at that game.
With a refuse to lose sign.
Yeah.
Right? Oh my God. And it was on the famous Cousin Katie's fridge for like 12 years after that.
That's probably accurate.
Until they moved to Pasco.
Another memory I have is that year at Christmas 1995, I had either the cold or the flu, which I got from you. And you were over it in time to like hang out with everyone on Christmas, but I was too sick to do it.
I just refused to lose.
Yeah. And so what, like that, they were playing that game. And I remember watching that sitting on the couch all by myself on Christmas.
Still great. Merry Christmas to you.
Yeah, I was winning. Little did I know. Played some Madden.
Oh my God.
Okay. So here's my big question about this.
Yes.
Is the double the greatest play in Seattle sports history, or is it the tip? One way or another.
I was at both.
Yeah. Fellow Tie alum, Stacey Ross, on Twitter was trending with her question about, like, what's the most iconic play that you were in attendance for, which apparently they were discussing in the 710 Seattle studios.
Wow, been in all of them.
Well, she didn't say Seattle necessarily. So my answer is actually probably Game 7 of the 2016 Finals.
Oh, you were there for the Kyrie shot?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That one's kind of tough
to beat. And the block?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's tough to beat.
Those are more iconic.
This is the tip. The Seahawks still won the Super Bowl.
You
were there for the most iconic moment in Cleveland sports history. Wow. Congrats.
By the way, it's weird that they just completely glossed over the entire ALCS. Again, they didn't have a lot of time.
I mean, what are you going to do?
Bob Wolcott?
Where Jay Buhner, like, homered and then made an air and then...
Homered again in extra
innings. Again. And I remember it was like...
Like what?
I remember the headline the next day was like, goat, hero, goat, or whatever.
It sounds about right. I mean, that was one of two games that won in the series. The other being game one, started by Bob Wolcott, who was added to the roster, I believe, between the division series and the ALCS, and had started like, you know, maybe like five games during the regular season. But game five was a close game. They lost that 3-2. That was a bummer.
For the Mariners' purposes, the most important moment of the ALCS was not the fact that they didn't win. It was Alex Rodriguez.
They didn't actually show Alex Rodriguez. They just mentioned that Joey Cora cried. They didn't mention Alex Rodriguez comforting him, which is kind of wild for like a 22-year-old.
Okay, so my Alex Rodriguez question for you. He says in that, it was probably the greatest moment in my entire career. And after
did he say that?
Yeah, in the documentary. Huh. And we were talking about he's in his rookie season, not his first season in the Mariners, but his rookie season. And he would go on to win MVPs, right? To win World Series after.
I mean, he won the batting title the next season.
He was a fucking monster the next year.
So good the next season.
What was the year? So there was the year that Edgar hit
358.
Edgar had a year that he hit 356, right?
Correct.
Was that 95?
I believe that was 95. He hit 343 in 92.
These numbers are unbelievable. Also, if it were modern times, we'd be like 462 on base percentage.
Yeah,
we wouldn't even know what his batting average was.
I mean, he led the league in on base percentage.
1.102 ops.
Wow, that was very close. It was 1107 in 95.
There we go.
Edgar's really good at hitting, man.
Yeah, famously.
So good. Led the league in on-base percentage three times.
But the most important moment for our purposes was that moment of A-Rod
and the standing ovation.
Do you feel like you got choked up watching it?
No.
Nah. I do now. I'm so much more emotional about it now than I was when I was 10.
I'm not that emotional.
Probably could be true for almost anything. I don't remember being too emotional about almost anything when I was 10.
All right, are we going to do our what if about what if the Mariners had moved?
I don't know.
We should touch on this quickly. First off, we should reminisce about, the other thing that we should reminisce about is the fact that I believe this was in 94, the year before, we had all picked who our favorite, a second favorite team in case the Mariners moved.
Wow, did we?
Yeah, and then we like all and traded all our chose, baseball cards.
We all chose the Braves. No,
no, I was probably the Indians, right? You chose the Indians, yeah. That's correct. And then it was like,
what did David Pelton choose? Do we remember?
I don't remember what our cousin David chose.
I'm assuming we did this with him.
Yes, I think that's a safe assumption. Possibly our friend Michael as well. I just know that I picked the Braves and you picked the Indians.
I mean, those are the two iconic. I really love the Marlins too, though.
The Braves were an easy choice because they were on TBS. You could watch them all the time.
And they had super fun players. Like when you play Griffey Baseball, which is also sort of kind of wrapped up in all this nostalgia.
Yes, even though it's not the 95 team.
No, I mean, the biggest bummer about Griffey Baseball is that Edgar Martinez isn't that good in it.
Yes.
And if I were
Edgar Martinez, like a little weakling.
I would still be upset about it if I were Edgar Martinez.
That's completely fair.
To this day. Because my child, when Luca is playing Griffey Baseball, he's like, Edgar Martinez couldn't have been that good.
Wow.
And he's like, Jay Buhner's huge.
Dave Valle is huge.
Yeah, Dave Valle. Oh my God.
Okay, so if the Mariners move after, let's say they play the 96 season in Seattle, because it probably would have been too quick to move them at that point. They move to Tampa Bay. Tampa Bay does not get an expansion team. I guess like DC gets the second expansion team at that point. And then who knows what happens with the Expos when they move in this alternate timeline.
Wow, if this timeline kept the Expos, I'm all in.
Yeah, you're into it. Griffey probably requests a trade at that point.
From wherever he is.
So he gets a trade.
Didn't he want to play in Tampa Bay, though? Wasn't that the thing? He wanted to play in, like... Ken Griffey Jr. had the craziest places to want to play.
Well, Cincinnati was, like, his hometown.
I know, but still. Like, that is... I just don't feel like I see that happening with modern athletes anymore.
I feel like A-Rod is from Florida. Maybe he stays if they're in Tampa Bay.
But he was Miami all the way.
All right, so... So the galaxy brain stuff here.
Okay.
All right. First off, the Seahawks, when they inevitably decide to build, ask for a new stadium as well, they build their stadium in the parking lot. They build it where Safeco is. And so they never play at Husky Stadium.
They were able to play it right next to the Kingdom.
As a result, is originally planned, the stadium has grass field instead of field turf.
Why doesn't it?
Paul Allen decided to like field turf after they played at Husky Stadium, which had it.
Oh, really? It was because of playing at Husky Stadium.
No one fact checked that. It sounds so good. I want it to be true. And that means then the summer schedule is open. The Sounders debut like years and years earlier than they actually did. We get the Sounders in like 2002 or something.
You really think we'd get soccer that early?
I mean, they were constantly on the expansion list.
All those white people had to go to something. You can edit that out. I'll leave that.
I don't know if the Sounders is successful if they debut in 2002.
You're probably right, though. No, I don't know.
I mean,
do you feel like the rise of craft beer had to happen for the Sounders to be good?
They came in at the perfect time.
Oh, yeah.
As it turned out.
Oh, yeah. The Fleet Foxes needed to exist at the same time as the Sounders.
All right, but the real thing is here. When the Sonics start to request money for a new arena... In the early 2000s, they're not the third team in line. People are like already upset about the fact that Safeco Field got, and eventually T-Mobile got voted in despite losing the public vote. Do the Sonics stay because the Mariners left?
There's almost no chance the Sonics move.
I mean, you can't let a second team go.
No.
And probably they build arena in where the Kingdom was.
It would be an embarrassment for the city if a second team moved.
Yeah.
I mean, in the same way that, I mean, obviously now it's a completely different climate with teams moving and stadiums and stuff like that, but it's never happening again. I mean, once it happens, I mean, this is what David Stern counted on. This is the future that David Stern wanted, right? Because he knows that when the threat exists, they're like, fuck it, we'll do it, right? And the same thing would have happened with the city of Seattle if a baseball team would have said, fuck it, we'll do it, and actually moved. Right?
Yeah.
So eloquently put.
And then Edgar Martinez is going into the Hall of Fame as a Tampa Bay or whatever. Tampa Bay. I guess they probably would have kept Mariners. That would have made sense with Tampa Bay.
I think you're definitely right that it was really about the timing, because all three kind of look for arenas around the same time. The Sonics were actually first, but they sort of half-assed it.
Yes. And it was, and as you, I'm sure you recall this, before they renovated Key Arena in 94, we talked about this in the podcast I did on the history of Key Arena with Bob Whitsitt. Their original plan was to build an arena where Safeco Fields was eventually built.
So why, what changed?
They ran out of money.
Who was paying for it? Like, Ackerley?
Yeah.
Huh.
He couldn't sell enough suites to you know, basically justify the expense.
That is wild. Also now, those suites would be sold out instantly.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, I mean, not even just being a team without, or a city without an NBA team. Almost any sport could sell out of the suites instantly. You could put a rugby team in CenturyLink Field and you'd sell out of suites.
Yeah, so it was being the third in line, really. But the other thing that hurt the Sonics, I think, is there was a perception among lawmakers, look, we saved the Mariners at the last minute. The Seahawks, the moving trucks literally started to move them to LA before the NFL prevented it and the lawsuit prevented it. Like, the same thing is going to happen here at the 11th hour.
You think they got cocky? Out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the 11th hour happened and the team got sold to Oklahoma City investors.
Is there anything else? I guess, I mean, we can all harp on the Sonics aspect of it because that's the obvious one.
Well, as we said last week, it's why this is actually like an exciting hypothetic. What if the Mariners moving? We trade the Mariners for the Sonics.
But also,
in a heartbeat.
Do you think that it would change our relationship with baseball?
Yes.
Would we dislike baseball earlier or would we become bigger fans of baseball?
No, we I don't know. I mean, it's weird because we were preparing for it.
There would be a team in Portland or Seattle right this second.
Well, maybe that's where the Expos move.
Back to Seattle or to Portland?
I don't know. But maybe that's what happens.
There would be, if the timing would have happened, they just would have gotten a team back here. There's no way that they would have looked at the situation and there wouldn't be a professional baseball team here. It's almost
especially
like
after the success of the Sounders.
No professional sports league that would look at Seattle and say, we don't want to have a team there, right? We want a team in Mexico City or Las Vegas.
No.
Kill me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are there any other things that you think would be different, though?
And those are the main ones.
It'd be pretty fascinating stuff.
It's a good alternate history.
What if Macklemore doesn't happen?
Wow. Well, first off, maybe he's not named Macklemore because Mark Macklemore never plays for the Mariners.
Mark Macklemore never plays for the Mariners. He's never able to make my oh my. Or maybe he still is because we're still, the 95 season is still happening. In
yeah, it still happens.
But doing a song nostalgic for the team that moved, like.
I can take a song nostalgic for the Sonics.
But nobody's getting behind that in the same way. If Dave Niehaus relocates to Tampa Bay and becomes a legend there, he probably would have. Right?
I don't know if he would feel the same way to the city of Tampa as he did to Seattle.
I'm just saying, I think Macklemore doesn't happen if the 95 Mariners move.
That's the real galaxy brain tech. I'm glad we've gotten here. This was well worth it.
Oh, my God.
By the way, the current Mariners are still bad.
There's your Mariners hot take. Don't burn yourself. What minute are we on?
48. So we're skipping the search for Seattle's best sandwich this week because
you talked about baseball for 45
You cannot
minutes.
Be troubled to go have any of these
okay,
sandwiches.
I'm gone all week at the mountains. I get back here. I'm competing my fucking hardest to do this podcast and you're criticizing me for...
Yeah, I am. Let's skip ahead to the Sounders who did not come in 2002. They came in 2009. And sadly,
Mariners.
Playing on field turf, suffered a 2-1 loss on Sunday to the arch rival Portland Timbers in a derby match that we both attended. It was the first home loss for the Sounders this season, having started 8-0-2 at CenturyLink Field. Now, when I left the stadium, I was feeling pretty upset about this performance, pretty down about this performance. And then I went and looked at the expected goals.
There we go.
And the Sounders pretty comfortably dominated this game in terms of expected goals.
There's nothing about what I watched that made me think they were going to dominate in expected goals.
They had 2.8 shot-based X goals to 1.9 for Portland.
How is this factored
in? 2.0 non-shot X goals to 0.8 for Portland. Well, they had, first off, they had 16 shots in this game.
Wow.
A number of them were on goal. A number of them were inside the box. From inside the box,
they did take a lot of good shots,
including a sitter that Rui Diaz missed off a feed from Jordan Morris in the 22nd minute.
There were some headers where it was like
a lot of Roman Torres headers. So many Roman Torres headers, but they struggled to find the finishing touch while Brian Fernandez made the most of both of his opportunities for Portland. Fernandez scored a brace in this one, both goals for the Timbers, and has now scored 4 goals in 2 matches against the Sounders since joining Portland as a designated player, including the U.S. Open Cup victory for Portland.
Is Brian Fernandez really good?
I mean, he's a DP. I mean, I don't know that much about his track record pre-MLS, but yes.
Yeah, clearly.
He's scoring at Real Madrid-esque levels, I guess I would say.
Wow.
It was really a bummer because the Sounders equalized this match and then conceded within a minute. Like, we were still cheering the goal.
When they equalized, I was like, Sounders are scoring another goal.
It just seemed like they were.
Just the feel for it. Like, they equalized and it was like, boom, it's coming. Second goal's coming within 10 minutes. And then when the Sounders scored, or when the Timbers scored that goal, it was like, it's over. Because they were able to park the bus at that point.
I mean, the Sounders still had some opportunities. They just couldn't find the finishing they needed. The Sounders will have a chance to get back on track Sunday at the Houston Dynamo, who would be outside the playoffs on a tiebreaker in the Western Conference if the season ended today. Again, like after reflecting, after moving, you know, taking a step back from this performance, it's not that much to worry about. Although I am concerned about Roman Torres' lack of pace at center back.
The whole back line does not look good.
It didn't. I mean, Portland didn't have a lot of possession in this game, but was effective on the counter when they did have the ball. Apparently, there are only like a week and a half left on Brad Smith's loan from Bournemouth.
Oh, no.
So we'll see what happens there.
It's pronounced Bournemouth, please. Bournemouth? You're editing that out. you're pausing to mark it to edit it out. You've been corrected about. You're gonna be like Bournemouth.
Gonna just spend like 10 minutes
repeating Bournemouth.
Bournemouth. So if he is to go back, Sounders have Jovan Jones to play at left.
Man, seeing Jovan Jones come in was pretty cool, though.
He's been playing basically exclusively midfield since he got here.
Really?
Yeah, and that's where he played on Sunday. And then also, of course, Nuhu, who came on late in that one and provided a little extra pace.
So we don't know whether Brad Smith's going back or not?
I haven't seen any reporting on it.
Okay. If this were a Seahawks player, we would have had like 8 weeks of reporting on it.
It would be really weird if the Seahawks were loaning a player.
But still, I'm just saying, if there was the potential... Wait, what is the day?
I guess early August. I saw 10 days on Saturday at heart.
If there was the possibility in like a week that a Seahawks player was just going to be gone and we had no idea about it.
Which, yeah, well, sometimes they get suspended and we have no idea about it. We'll get to that in a minute.
Like, there would be a lot of reporting on what was going down.
Yeah, that's true. Reign FC had last weekend off, returns this Sunday hosting Chicago Red Stars in the return of their players from the World Cup.
Hello.
As we discussed last week, a sold-out match at Cheney Stadium. The Red Stars moved into a tie with the Reign for third in the NWSL standings last weekend, though the Reign have a game in hand. 7 players will be back for the Reign, highlighted, of course, by Megan Rapinoe and her U.S. WNT teammate, Allie Long.
Wow. If we weren't going to Tri-City Water Follies...
And if it wasn't sold out. And if it wasn't in Tacoma.
Are these all sold out? How many
tickets? Like upcoming matches?
Yeah.
I think strictly this one is sold out.
How many tickets do they hold there?
I do not know that.
Give me a guess. Rough guess.
I mean, 15,000 maybe?
15,000?
10 to 15, somewhere
there. We
there.
Go. I mean, I appreciate
it. People are excited.
During the World Cup, so many people were talking about like why is women's soccer not at the same level as men's soccer? And I really appreciate, granted, we have in our hometown the star of the US and WNT, but like I appreciate that people are actually putting their money where their mouths are.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Let's hope they continue doing it.
Because to me, when people talk in sort of these like hypothetical terms of like, why is this not as big as this? It's like, you can change that. You as a person, granted, one person is not changing everything, but sort of culturally...
What you're saying is be the change you want to see in the world.
Be the change you want to see in the world. And that's what the people fucking Tacoma are doing here. Also, I think the team should be called the Tacoma Rain.
Even though they want to represent the entire Northwest.
Then they should be called the Washington Rain.
Okay.
They're Seattle because they want to represent the entire Northwest. But anyway, what I'm saying is...
They're not any.
They're nothing. Oh, they're just Rain FC.
Yeah, we've been over this multiple times.
No, we haven't.
I'm sure we have.
No.
Just like we've been over that they moved to Tacoma.
That I forgot about. I was picturing Memorial Stadium in my mind.
Just every week, it's going to be a discussion of where Rain FC plans from here on out.
I'm like, so what are they going to do during Bumbershoot?
Oh, no.
But anyway, I heard a lot of conversations during the World Cup where people are like, why is it not like this? And I really appreciate that.
It's cool.
Yeah.
Support the NWSL. Watch some games. They're coming. They're on ESPN. They just signed a TV deal with ESPN.
I mean, I'm not willing to drive to Tacoma, though.
It's a long drive. The Seattle Storm. A 69-66 win on Friday versus Las Vegas that I attended last week after going to to Capitol Hill Block Party. Not Bumbershoot. Then on Tuesday, went to Las Vegas.
There's a Rain game happening.
The return match and lost 79-62. Kind of ran out of steam in the second half of that one. That was their last game before the All-Star break. The All-Star game will take
place. How many times do you have Las Vegas type?
A lot of Las Vegas. The All-Star game is Saturday in Las Vegas at Mandalay Bay, where the Aces already play. Jewel Lloyd was selected third overall by Elena Deladon in the All-Star draft just prior to that game on Tuesday. Well, Natasha Howard was the last pick among starters by Asia Wilson's team. Wilson suffered a high ankle sprain in that match against this match, that game against the Storm. I'm talking too much soccer. That game against the Storm. She will not be able to play in the All-Star game. So,
if the Mariners would have moved, Natasha the Howard. Women's basketball games would be called matches.
Amazing what if. On a more serious note, in filing for divorce last week, Storm forward Natasha Howard requested and was granted a restraining order against her wife Jacqueline, who goes by Jackie. In that filing, alleged that Jackie transferred nearly $600,000 out of a joint bank account into one in Jackie's name only, and also that Jackie had stabbed her in the back with a knife while she was playing in Korea in 2016, resulting in a hospital stay. So now we have counterclaims of domestic violence and serious, quite serious claims on both sides of this relationship now. So, we'll sort of see how this plays out now that it's in the legal system as opposed to just on Twitter.
Well, I mean, this is where it should play out.
Yes. As Howard said, and Natasha Howard said in her divorce filing. UW men's basketball pairings announced for Pac-12 play. The Huskies won't travel to the Oregon schools this year.
Thank God. I part of me feels like we should play the Oregon schools every year.
It does feel like it.
But also, not having to travel to Oregon and Oregon State.
It's good news. The mountain schools, Utah and Colorado, won't come to Seattle this year. Husky football, Wednesday was Pac-12 Media Day. The Huskies were represented there by a pair of seniors, center Nick Harris and cornerback Miles Bryant. The Pac-12 media poll, Oregon narrowly favored over UW to win the North by a single vote. Utah, which lost to the Huskies in last year's Pac-12 championship game, picked to win the Pac-12 outright, largely because they're seen as having a clearer path to the title game.
Okay. I was going to say, I don't know if you can see the incredulous face that I'm giving, but whomever wins the North is winning the Pac-12.
We'll see.
I guess I can sort of see where they're coming from.
It's sort of like picking the Bucks to win the championship, even if you don't think they're the best team in the NBA. It means they're just a much deeper field in the Western Conference. Well,
last year.
No, this year.
I mean,
where the Raptors don't exist.
Okay.
They won the championship. I don't know if you were this. The East won the championship.
I don't know if I would say that there's any team in the West that's like clearly better than the Bucks.
I mean, I think people generally think the Clippers are the best team.
Yeah.
Myself included.
But maybe the Clippers are... The Clippers, and I don't know who you would consider second.
Probably the Lakers or the Jazz.
There you go. The Northwest, UW and Oregon are the Clippers and the Lakers.
Buffett said that. I don't know which...
I'm standing by my incredulous look about...
Is Jacob Eason Anthony Davis in this scenario?
Yeah, he is.
Coach Pete is LeBron.
Jacob Eason's Kawhi.
But no, I guess the Huskies can't be the Lakers because they made the playoffs last
Coach
year.
Pete is Steve Ballmer. I don't know.
The other notable announcement on from Pac-12 Media Day is that Commissioner Larry Scott announced that the Pac-12 title game is headed to the new Las Vegas Stadium in 2020 and 2021. A very exciting development. I'm way more likely to go to a Pac-12 title game in Las Vegas than
Hello?
I am in Santa Clara.
This is big news.
It is.
Right? From everything that I know
about, it's not surprising.
About Santa Clara.
We kind of knew it was happening.
Is that it's the worst place to travel to on the entire earth.
There are worse places. If you fly into San Jose, it's not so bad.
Okay, I've heard your description of getting there.
Oh, from downtown San Francisco, yes.
It's like, I will never go to this place.
It's easier to fly to LA and drive to Las Vegas from LA than it is to fly to San Francisco and go to Santa Clara. That's my takeaway.
There are no human beings in San Jose.
No, that's the problem, is there's too many human
beings along
in
the way.
Silicon Valley.
I'm not going to lie. I'm about this action, boss. Because
you got a chance to go to the Pac-12 title game on a Friday night, bet on the college champion, other college championships on Saturday,
oh my God,
bet on NFL football on Sunday. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
The Huskies have to be good. Like, I'm just saying, we need sustained success here to make this happen.
I like their chances.
We're counting on you, Coach Pete. You got to make some Pac-12 championship games here.
He's already made two, so, you know.
But I'm just saying, think about...
You don't think that's sufficient?
But I'm talking percentage-wise. Like, how many years did the Huskies go without being in a Pac-12 championship game? I guess
I can't remember what year the Pac-12 championship game started, but all of those.
All of them until they did.
Yeah.
Right?
And I mean, that's true of everyone.
It would have been like 2000. What was the 2001? They probably would have
gone. That was the last year they were equivalent to that?
Yeah.
Yes.
Would have been like 14 years.
They first did it in 2016.
That's when the Huskies first went.
I believe so.
So it would have been like 15 years. I would be 60 years old when that happens. So.
I don't think that math checks out. That's some hashtag Peltoncast math.
Also, the reality is eventually it's... Well, I don't know if this is going to happen. I was going to say. Eventually there'll be a time that the Seahawks play in Vegas and it lines up with the Pac-12 championship game. But I know that's probably not going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, first off, they only play in Vegas once every 4 years. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Yes.
Or once every 8 years, yeah. I should say.
They play the team once every 4 years. If we were in the AFC West,
I mean,
it would eventually happen.
They'll probably play a lot of preseason games in Vegas.
That's not going to help.
No, those won't line up with the Pac-12 championship, as it turns out. All right, well, before we wrap up by bringing on our third Pelton brother, Mike Sando, let's talk some Seahawks news. Veterans reported to training camp on Wednesday with the first practice on Thursday. And I'll check my tweet deck here, but it does not appear that we've gotten any news on a Bobby Wagner extension, which is somewhat surprising that this hasn't gotten taken care of before training camp. Ian Rappaport of NFL Network reported that Wagner will report to camp, but will be cautious and, quote, may not put himself in harm's way until a deal is done here. The biggest Seahawks news this week, disappointing news, that defensive tackle Jaron Reed suspended for the first six games of the 2019 season, stemming from a 2017 domestic violence incident for which he was neither arrested nor charged. The Bellevue Police Department recommended fourth-degree assault charges, but city prosecutors declined to bring charge due to insufficient evidence, as they explained in a statement released on Tuesday. The arrest report indicated the woman who had been in a relationship with Reed said that she got into an argument with him at his home during a party, and Reed grabbed her by the throat before releasing her. Later, Reed grabbed her by the wrist and dragged her across the bedroom floor and down a couple of stairs before she was able to break free and call police. She told police that she suffered injuries to her right wrist and left elbow in this incident. So, you know, certainly... Not anything you want to read about a Seahawks player's behavior. To help replace Reed during this suspension, the Seahawks signed defensive tackle Earl Mitchell on Wednesday to add depth. He spent the last two seasons with the 49ers after playing for the Texans and Dolphins previously in his NFL career. Mitchell had an option decline in the last 2 years of his contract in July. or in January, I should say, the Seahawks brought him in for a visit in March before eventually signing Al Woods instead as a free agent defensive tackle. Mitchell started 28 of 30 games for the 49ers, so, you know, he's certainly a credible option at defensive tackle, just not the kind of interior pass rushing presence that the Seahawks had in Reed.
Still a pretty good signing, though, this, like, right before training camp starts.
Yeah, all things considered.
I mean, this is what the Seahawks do.
They were aware of their options. I mean, obviously, you know, even though we hadn't heard anything in the public about this Reed suspension, this was something that they knew was in the works before his appeal was denied last Friday. So, you know, I think that they had been considering their options for a while. People were speculating about Mike Daniels after the Packers were reported on Wednesday that they're going to release their defensive lineman, a Pro Bowler in 2017. But, you know, Mike Garofalo of NFL Network had said that the Seahawks were headed in another direction, and clearly that was Mitchell.
Interesting.
Speaking of reports from the NFL Network, Tom Pelissero reported that Ezekiel Ansah will start training camp on the Seahawks active roster rather than the PUP list. Still limited early in camp, of course, as he works back from surgery, but, you know, encouraging sign that he may be able to contribute early in the schedule, if not even in week one. And the Seahawks, with their pass rush, you know, hit by the Jaron Reed suspension, need him now more than ever. And they already needed him a lot after the Frank Clark trade.
I mean, just need to get him back by week one. Like, I don't, like, it's nice that he's not on the PUP list, which makes you feel a little bit better about it. We don't need to see Ziggy Ansah practicing that much.
Well,
we don't need to see him in a preseason game.
The big thing here is, if you thought there was a chance he was going to miss time during, you know, multiple weeks during the regular season, you would keep him on the PUP list so that he wouldn't, you know, cost a roster spot during that period of time.
So let me ask you about the pass rush in general. I know that we'll talk a little bit more about this with Mike Sando, but it's obviously affected. And especially the interior pass rush, I think we should anticipate for those 6 weeks not getting much, if any.
Yes.
Where is pass rushing going to come from?
So hopefully Ansah is healthy. Barkevious Mingo in a full-time defensive end role, perhaps. I mean, Cassius Marsh is going to be the, you know, for a period of time here, probably for the first 6 weeks of the season until Reed is back, he'll be the leading 2018 sacker on the Seahawks with 5.5.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's not that bad.
Which is more than Ansah had during his injury-shortened season in Detroit last year.
Do we think
that's actually pretty bad for your best pass rusher?
It's more than I thought Cassius Marsh had.
Yeah. He had a good season last year. I liked the signing.
Do I think we're maybe underrating the potential for LJ Collier being a competent NFL pass rusher?
No. I mean, the scouting report,
cool.
even the pro LJ Collier scouting reports are more about, you know, he's going to be a really good, solid run stopping defensive end, not necessarily a pure pass rusher.
Great.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess what you're hoping are Ziggy Ansah is healthy.
Yes.
Somebody else breaks out.
Barkevious Mingo.
Rasheem Green, somebody like that.
Yeah, that's another possibility.
Some player that we're
Naz Jones playing defensive end more frequently.
Oh, is he playing a little bit more defensive end?
That's the plan.
Nice. So, all right. It's going to be bad.
Well, for a little more dose of optimism.
This photo of you has become a meme on the internet now?
It has, yes.
You must not be happy about that.
I'm not thrilled about it.
It was in the storm thing?
It was in the video of the storm dead, yes. And it was the cover photo.
Oh,
even
no.
though it wasn't the beginning of the video.
Oh, no.
That was not my choice.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's not my single favorite photo of me that's ever been taken. All right, with that, I think it's time to bring in Mike Sando. We've talked about QB tiers on the podcast many times, but have never gone to the source. And it's too bad. It's unfortunate that it took until we are no longer colleagues at ESPN Plus. Congrats on joining The Athletic this week, where congrats on joining The Athletic last week, where now you have published your annual QB tiers. Thanks so much for joining us, Mike Sando.
Thank you. It's all downhill from here. You know, I'm going to have a hard time topping this one for the rest of the year, but it is my favorite project. So
yeah. Understandably so. I think probably the one that generates the most discussion.
Yes. Oh, no doubt. I mean, when in doubt, talk about the quarterbacks, right? I mean, it's the one position in football that everybody watches. And if you know nothing about the game, if you watch your local team every week, you probably have a somewhat accurate opinion on them just from watching them.
And all of those opinions, weirdly, are that their quarterback is underrated by QB tiers.
Yeah, well, that's a lot of them. But there's also a lot of people who don't want to see their quarterback anymore. Although the quarterback quality is better, I will say that. That's one thing I noticed. When Josh Rosen is last, you're like, oh, he actually has some upside. So it's a good state of the league right now in terms of quarterbacks.
Indeed, yeah. I think we'll come back to that in a second. But first, I wanted to ask kind of what was the origin, what's the history of QB tiers?
Well, basically, you know, division of credit is a very hard thing to do in sports, and especially in football. It's such a chaotic game with so many moving parts. And you start with the quarterback position is the most important position, but as you know from watching the draft, I mean, no one really knows how to hire them half the time, right? So there's some mystery to projecting the position. But I think people have largely figured out good ones when they see them. And so really for me, it was just sort of distilling down and trying to separate the quarterback who wins because of things around him from the guy who is driving more of the success of this team. And we see that obviously at the extreme. Everyone would know Tom Brady or Aaron Rodgers. But when you put him into tiers like this, you sort of realize that your guy's not that special, probably. There's 15 other guys like him in tier three. And don't get the false hope that, hey, you know what? Andy Dalton's going to turn the corner this year. I mean, this is it. He really looked good in training camp. No, he's a three last year, and he's a three next year.
Right. Well, one quarterback who did change tiers this year is the quarterback who we are looking for on this list, Russell Wilson, as I mentioned. It's kind of been an interesting progression looking at this since it began in 2014. That year, he was tied for eighth. In 2015, eighth. 2016, sixth after that big end of the 2015 season. 2017 dropped a little to 10th coming off the ankle injury that limited his mobility and his production that season. Sixth last year, and then eighth this year. But it's simultaneously, to the point you made earlier, it's the first time that he's leaped up from tier two, where he's been in throughout this period, up to the top tier of quarterbacks, which just, I believe, is larger than it's ever been before. Am I correct?
It is, yeah. In the 6 years I've done this, I've never had this many. There's eight. And basically what's happened is there's been some good development of quarterbacks, and the old guys aren't going away. You know, you've got Rivers and Roethlisberger, and Brady is 42. No one would have seen that. Drew Brees still hanging on. Even Rodgers is older. So, and then, you know, you get Mahomes comes in, Luck gets healthy again. You know, it's really about as good as it's been.
Absolutely. Did the tone of the feedback on Russell Wilson change this year? This being the first time where he's gotten, you know, moved into that first tier, and also the first time, naturally, that he's gotten more votes in tier one than tier two?
I don't think so. You know, really, I think the tone changed in the last couple of years. You know, I think what's happened is we've seen what it looks like when the Seahawks don't have a defense that even a below average quarterback could win with. I mean, they were historically great on defense for so long that you need your quarterback occasionally to bail you out, but they didn't ask as much from them. And so I think that started to change the last couple of years. And really going to tier one from tier two, he was so close to tier one that it's really just a few votes flipping over. So that could even be variance in the people I'm talking to. It's not the same people every year. I mean, some of them are the same, but you know, that's all it takes. I mean, people are like, how did Matt Ryan not make it? It's like, well, three guys put him in tier two, and if they put him in tier one, he'd be tier one. Well, you know, we're basically, there's not a lot of differentiation around the margins. So I don't think it's a huge, wow, he's finally tier one. He's been pretty good the whole time.
Right. I mean, something else I was curious about, the fact that he is eighth on this list, but got the largest quarterback contract ever. Is that an indication, do you think, that kind of anyone in this tier one, whenever they come up, is going to get that? I mean, subject to age. Obviously, many of these guys are much older, whereas Wilson, you know, Andrew Luck and Rodgers is closer to his prime. But any of these guys, when they come up, is going to become the highest paid quarterback, just subject to timing?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I am so bored by the contract details for these guys because it's not, it's merit-based to a degree, but it's like, if you're a starting quarterback and your contract comes up, you're making 20 some million. And if you're one of the better ones, it's 30 some million. So yes, if it's a, if you're a Matt Ryan, a Russell Wilson, you know, Roethlisberger, Luck, whenever they come up, they just go to the top and, you know, it's all reported highest record contract. And it's like, well, okay, until the next guy signs one in 5 minutes, you know?
Mike, I feel like it's important to jump here in here and just really quick get you to summarize who's voting on these tiers. Because I feel like when this comes out and maybe you get some of this blowback also, people will assume that this is just you ranking the players based on your preference, right?
Yeah, that was definitely an issue early on in how people characterize it. I think people that are more familiar with it understand that it is a composite look at the league. But yeah, so this time, 55 people, it's 8 general managers, 7 head coaches, 12 coordinators, 11 personnel directors, 7 quarterback coaches, and 10 other. And the other are, you know, it could be a secondary coach, an analytics director, you know, those types of people that are close to the game but don't fit into one of the other bigger, wider buckets.
Okay. I mean, the thing that struck me the most looking at this tier one, and, you know, obviously quarterbacks have fluctuated throughout time, but seeing quarterbacks like Phil Rivers and Ben Roethlisberger be on there, it felt like almost experience in the NFL to get to that tier, aside from Pat Mahomes, who's the reigning MVP. It would be almost ludicrous to not put him in this tier. Do you feel like that's one of the bigger factors in how a quarterback is perceived throughout the league?
You mean that he's been doing it well for a long time?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, no doubt. And so the long, I think like Rodgers, even though he didn't have as great of a season last year, you know, people aren't just totally reevaluating what they think of him. It probably takes you a little extra time to climb the mountain, and it takes you a little extra time to fall off the mountain. Even the year that Peyton Manning's last year was 2015. If you remember that, kind of going into that year, he had some rough spots and then he fell off a cliff. Remember that?
Yes.
If you look at the 2015 quarterback tiers, you know, it wasn't like unanimous tier ones, but he got enough to finish in tier one, even though I think people sort of suspected that he wasn't going to be tier one. They were just sort of like, you know, I'm not going to take him out until he proves that he's out, but I think he's definitely descending. On Rivers and Roethlisberger, I think Roethlisberger benefits from, you know, I mean, he is a good quarterback, but, you know, he's won a couple Super Bowls, and I think he has to play his way out of it with a little bit more longer, spotty play. And Rivers, I think, deserves to be there because he has reduced the interceptions. You know, Roethlisberger, I think, the last 3 years has tied for the league in picks with Winston and Cam Newton. And Rivers was that guy 2 or 3 years ago, and he has dialed it back.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like when I look at this, it's not even necessarily like a ranking of who's going to be the best quarterback next season in the NFL. It's almost like, where does your career stand right now among active quarterbacks? Which is why I wanted to ask about Aaron Rodgers really quick. Because seeing him in the top spot, I mean, and I want to talk about other quarterbacks that surprised you. But I was just going back through statistically Aaron Rodgers, his previous 5 seasons. And you look in DVOA, 2018, he's 13th, 2017. Well, I'll just go in order. 13th, 14th, 8th, 17th, 1st. So we're going back to 2014 that he was a quarterback who, by DVOA, warranted having a spot like that. And then also looking at QBR, who he was much better in 2016, but he was 16th. I think he was injured in 2017, so might have been unrated. And then 4th, 14th, and 2nd, where these aren't terrible seasons, but Aaron Rodgers being considered the best quarterback in the NFL by any statistical measure, it's been a pretty significant amount of time since that's been the case.
You know, this may not surprise you, but none of the 55 people brought up DVOA or QBR. They don't need to because they got their eyes and they watched the guy. And they know what it's like to face these guys. And you start talking to defensive guys, they just shake their head. I mean, they know what he can do, and they're not basing it on a statistical analysis. I think the statistical analysis is helpful, but it's especially helpful when you don't know what the coaches know. And that's why those of us in the media love it. I mean, we dive into it, and it helps us understand the game in a different way.
Do you think this is kind of a prove-it season for Rodgers? Because I think one of the arguments that people, yes, his supporters would make is he's been held back in this Mike McCarthy system that's been criticized as uncreative. Now he's got, you know, a new system. It's a chance to prove that, you know, find out one way or another, I guess, how to divide the blame for the fact that he hasn't been producing at that level the last few years.
Yes. So, and if you read the piece, you can see, if you didn't know what Rodgers' votes were, and you read what people are saying about him, you can see the concerns creeping in. And I think what happens is, so people are seeing some of the things that even you were describing with the statistics. But at the end of the day, it's really hard to put him below Matt Stafford. So, you know, the guys can't say, you know what, I'm going to give him a 1.7. You know, you sort of got to, you either decide, is he still a one or not? Mm-hmm. And I think on Rodgers, there's no question those concerns are there. You know, some of the quotes in there were like, hey, when it starts to be two people's fault, meaning like Ted Thompson and Mike McCarthy, you begin to wonder. And like one of the stats I found interesting on him was just how much longer he held the ball than in the past. You know, the time to pass stat went way up for him. Well, that's exactly what people said. He's freelancing. And that's what mm-hmm. the coaches were saying, too. So, you know, I didn't mean to be dismissive of the stats. I just laughed when I hear DVOA because it's not what the coaches are talking about. I didn't mean it as a shot on stats because I love the stats, too. But I think that's where the stats and what people are saying line up. People are seeing that. But are you going to make him a two? And so if you were to fill out your ballot, would you make Rodgers a two? Probably not. But you would say, let's move him down a few notches, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's an interesting one. And obviously, I do think maybe they're the eye test for coaches. It could be a point of weakness too, but we're sort of looking at this as sort of understanding throughout the league how these quarterbacks are viewed.
Yep, absolutely. No one's lining up to want to play Rodgers, you know, even though that stuff's going on. And if you could have a quarterback, if you didn't have Rodgers, you know, you'd strongly consider taking Rodgers, you know?
Yep.
I mean, obviously, if we're picking nits about how players are viewed too, seeing somebody like Andrew Luck being ahead of Russell Wilson, a quarterback who's won a Super Bowl at the same time versus somebody who's never played in one, if we want to pick nits there about how they're viewed throughout the league and statistically also, we can do that. But
wait a minute. Are you saying that you would have Wilson way ahead of Luck?
I wouldn't have him way ahead.
Way ahead. I'm not saying way ahead necessarily, but ahead for sure.
So here's you know, what we have to get on the quarterbacks is the more you've had to do for your team, the right. more credit you get. So Russell Wilson has played 26 more games than Andrew Luck since he came into the league, and he's thrown fewer passes.
That's pretty wild.
Since 2012, Drew Brees has thrown 1,100 more passes than Russell Wilson. That's what people in the league are saying when they look. That's sort of the calculus here is, look, we know Russell Wilson's good, but he hasn't been asked to do what the other guys have to do. Russell Wilson played with a historically great defense that allowed so few points that it's an 80 to 90% win if Alex Smith's playing for him. It doesn't mean he's as good as Alex Smith. It means he hasn't had to throw those extra 1,100 passes that Drew Brees has or thrown even more, you know, like Luck throwing 650 in a year. You're definitely exposed to a higher level of risk, and it's a harder way to play the position, especially if people think you're going to pass, know you're going to pass because you don't have a defense bailing you out. Think of Russell Wilson's amazing performance against Green Bay in the playoffs. Remember when they had the big comeback?
Uh-huh.
How many times does he get the ball when the score didn't change?
Right.
How many times does the ball keep coming back to him and it's still the same score? Well, that's a huge advantage for any quarterback. It doesn't mean Russell Wilson's not good. It means he's played a different game. Last year, here's something I measure. I look at the first 28 minutes of the game. How much do you pass on early downs? You know what the answer. They passed 36% of the time. Well, Ben Roethlisberger passed 70%. Who's playing? And everyone's going to say, oh, they're underutilizing Russell Wilson. Well, no. Have you seen his offensive line? I think they're playing smart to some degree, but it's not letting Russell Wilson do what some of the other guys are doing. It's still helping him win the game. Pete Carroll knows how to win the game. He doesn't want a Fetty out there pass blocking on 70% of early downs to start the game.
Can we get a little bit higher?
I was curious.
Yes, and they will. I mean, I've talked to them about it. I've showed them the numbers. I mean, I've talked to Brian Schottenheimer and Carroll about it. And yes, they will.
Wait, tell us more about you showing them the numbers. What do they say when you show them the numbers?
Well, that they know that that's an extreme number last year. So that will correct to some degree. But I think that it's clear how Pete Carroll wants to win the game. I mean, he wants a small number of turnovers. He wants very explosive pass offense and he wants to control the game.
Well, I was curious to that point. Among the people you talk to, does anyone bring up the fact that he is used so differently than any of the other tier one quarterbacks? And did anyone suggest that, you know, maybe the Seahawks are underutilizing Wilson?
Yeah, one of the quotes in there is his hands are tied a little bit. You know, I think that Russell could do more than he's asked to do. And I think he has done more at certain times. I mean, a couple of years ago, they weren't at 36%. You know, they were higher. They were more normal. So, but I don't know that they were better. I mean, did you think they were better? I mean, maybe they were. They're trying to play to a formula to win the game, not prove that Russell Wilson's a tier one quarterback.
You know, obviously you've been soliciting feedback specifically for this lately, but as you talk to people around the league, what are the expectations? What are the sense about the Seahawks this season?
Wait, I want to talk about quarterbacks first, but before we get there, I'm just curious, not necessarily mitigating any, we can talk about Russell Wilson more later, but just in general about the list, were there any surprises that you had coming out of it?
Yep. So my basic surprises are 8 guys in tier one. I guess when I look at it afterwards, I say, okay, I wouldn't necessarily kick a bunch of guys out of there, but that surprised me a little bit. I think I wasn't sure where Baker Mayfield would go because, you know, sometimes guys are hard graders. They want to see it. They could resist the anointing thing, you know,
right.
But they kind of anointed him. They put him in the second tier, bought him in the second tier, but still a little bit of a surprise to me. Cam Newton, I thought being at the top of three, he's hovered between on the border of 2 and 3, but I thought he was pretty good last year until he got hurt. I would probably have him a little higher than that. And then beyond that, not really. You know, I thought Prescott could be a nick or two higher. You know, I thought he finished the season better, but I think for the most part, you look at it and go, yeah, I'd change a couple things, but not a lot.
I thought Wentz being 10th and second in tier two behind Matt Ryan was a little surprising to me, given just the question marks about his durability at this point.
I'm with you too. And you know, some of the people, so he got 3 in tier three, which, you know, is probably accounting for the injuries, but there are a lot of people think that he could carry the team, but hasn't had to. And I buy that. I think they've had a good defense and run game for the most part when he's played, not to say he hasn't played well. I mean, he was amazing on third down a couple years ago, but I think they've got a good team. And I don't know how much – I think people look at him, and he's a big, strong, great thrower guy, and he gets a little bit of the Andrew Luck
I'm still hearing some sort of NFL bullshit in here. Like, this is obviously not anything that you're saying, but it's like Carson Wentz gets put up higher because he could lead the team if he had more, but Russell Wilson doesn't get the same kind of respect because he hasn't had to lead the team.
Well, what happened on draft day? They took a punter before Russell Wilson, correct? The league did, right? And after the draft...
Famously.
And if you could go back and give me exactly what you said after that draft, it probably wasn't, wow, they found their next starting quarterback. It was probably like, they just paid Matt Flynn and they took this guy, I think a 5'10 guy in the third round.
I think we were pretty stoked about Russell Wilson.
I had bought into that football outsider's projection.
But it wasn't like the next day everyone was giving a maze. for the draft, you know. So
definitely not.
There's reasons Andrew Luck went first overall. He's different physically than Russell Wilson is, correct? Yep. You could run any offense with Andrew Luck with zero limitation. They do things to help Russell Wilson.
Yeah. All right, so to go back to that question, what have you been hearing in your conversation with people as far as their expectations for the Seahawks this season?
There's tremendous respect for what they're doing. They've done on the defensive side of the ball to overhaul that without becoming absolutely horrific on defense. So I think people are still expecting them to you know, be back in the 9-10 win range and be a competitive team. But I don't think that people are expecting them to win the division. And there is enough uncertainty on the defensive side that some of the people I've talked to think there's potential to be really bad. But they sort of give John and Pete the benefit of the doubt on the defensive side because they've done better than people expected while turning it over. Mm-hmm.
Do we agree with this perspective? Because I look at this defense and it's scary to me, right? I mean, I feel as far as players who you can look at and say, like, yes, this is a star level NFL player, or even necessarily like an above replacement level NFL starter. I see Bobby Wagner and
Ansa if he's healthy, Jaron Reed when he comes back, and KJ Wright if healthy. I think that's the way.
Yeah, I like Griffin, and I think Flowers.
Bradley Jewell too.
I mean, I know internally some of them think Flowers could be their best corner. We'll see if that happens. But I think they have a good history of. I think one of the great things they do is never have to take a corner early because they just keep developing them. So I would have big concerns about the pass rush, question marks on the nickel corner spot. I think their linebacker depth's better than it's been. That's been a trouble spot. But I sort of see them a little bit like when they were, you know, you could go back to whatever that season, you know, maybe Russell's rookie year, you know, remember when they lost the playoff game to the Falcons and they just didn't have the pass rush?
Yep.
Yeah.
They're sort of, now the difference is I think Russell's definitely better. And, you know, I think offensively, even last year when they supposedly were just horrific on offense, they scored like 26 points a game with their terrible plan for where they didn't throw the ball nearly enough and weren't with the program. They scored 26 points a game. So I think they have capability on offense. I think that's a good season when you score 26 points a game, and they need to do that because I don't think their defense is going to be, you know, winning the game for them. And I think they have to control the games too. You know, I think if you go out there and try to spray it around the yard and give too many possessions to the other team, I think they'll be chasing points. I think they'll be in trouble.
So as we record this, you're preparing to head to the first practice on Thursday. Yep. Out in Renton, home of the Super Bowl 48 champions. What are you looking for as you head out there? What are this kind of the things to watch in training camp and then leading into the preseason this year in your mind?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, not having Baldwin there, I want to see Wilson with these receivers. You know, I think that that's fascinating. Metcalf's fascinating. I mean, the feedback after the draft was like total boom or bust. So, and they were like amazingly high on him from the offseason camp. So I think that's a natural position. I was really surprised Ziggy Ansah wasn't put on the injured list. You know, that was like the talk I had been hearing was like missing games and, you know, cleared to practice. I don't know. I didn't see. Is he practicing tomorrow or is he just cleared to practice? I'm not sure. But, he's interesting to me because, God, do they need him more than ever? Yep. You get rid of Frank Clark and now you lose Reed. I realize they signed Earl Mitchell, but they need a pass rush. So where's that coming from? How does Ansa look? I really want to see him.
Yeah, I think those are what we'll all be watching.
Yeah, I think your reference to that playoff game against Atlanta where they just couldn't find pass rush is sort of, I think, how we're going to go into the season approaching the Seahawks. And their question mark, I mean, like, LJ Collier.
I mean, the good news is they only had like two Hall of Famers on the secondary in that team.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I've just seen them too many times on the defensive side. I don't know as much on the offensive side, but, you know, fill the spots. And I asked Ken Norton at the off season camp. I was actually, Brock Heward and I were standing there and we're like, oh, you know, no one was making plays on defense, you know, and we were just talking about how, God, remember when they used to have so many studs on defense, they would be making plays left and right. And I actually asked Ken Norton about it after the practice. And he was like, well, I mean, the main reason is because none of our starters are out there. And he listed off about 10 guys that weren't practicing. I guess that was part of it. But still, you're not seeing the established guys, you know. I mean, there's a lot more uncertainty. So I think people thought they were going to have a bad year last year, and they didn't have a great year, but don't you think they did better than people thought?
Oh, for sure.
They won more definitely games than people thought. So I'm just sort of like, here's what sort of bothers me, and this is why I have the tone that I do, and I'm kind of mocking the people that are saying they don't know what they're doing, is when somebody continually exceeds your expectations and wins 10 or more games every year with players that no one thought they should have drafted, do you think we could learn something from them? Or do you think we have it all figured out with our fancy stats and our spreadsheets? Who do you think has it figured out? Pete Carroll, who's been doing this for 35 years and always wins, and his winning percentage in New England when he was a total failure was 56%, which is higher than career winning percentages for Hall of Fame coaches. Do you think he has it figured out, or do you think we do?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you took this personnel, especially aside from Russell Wilson, and put it with any other coaching staff and organization, then you'd be really dire in terms of your pessimism. I just think in terms of talent, they're not quite where they were even last year.
Yeah, yeah, yep. And, you know, another big player for this team is Disley. You know, I think he was a huge part of the offense early, and I don't know how well you come back from that injury. So there's question marks all over the place. We know they've got Pete Carroll. We know they've got Russell Wilson, and that's a good thing to start with. I'm sort of curious, how are they going to pull this off this year? Because we didn't think they were last year, but we know it's going to be through the same style of play, a similar style of play. My point is that style of play has been pretty successful. And everybody seems to think that if they'd only do X, Y, and Z, they'd be even better. But then how come everyone keeps saying they're not going to be good, you know, and they're usually good.
Yeah.
And we'll see if they can do it again. They may not, but if they don't, it'll be the first time since Russell Wilson got there.
Yeah. All right. Well, that seems like a good place to wrap this up. Mike, thanks so much for the time.
I appreciate it. I've set back analytics by 10 years by defending these guys, but
I'm biting my tongue over here.
I love all that stuff too. I love the numbers. I live in the numbers. I've got Excel spreadsheets with 800,000 rows in them. I'm not kidding, of data. I love it, but I think there's more to it than that. So that's my point.
We're going to have your athletic colleague Ben Baldwin on next week.
I love him. Yeah. I love him. I go back with him on Twitter, but yeah. I'm going to go with Pete. I'm going to say Pete Carroll might know how to win the games better than the rest of us.
So if you're not already subscribed to The Athletic, QB Tiers, yet another reason to do so. Hope everyone checks it out and continues to check out your work all year long.
Hey, I hope they do too. Thank you.